everyone. There's only so much time in the day. That's why we edited this Vermont Edition podcast for brevity. I know you'll thank us.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Yesterday I was out in the sun and I got bitten by something. I'm thinking maybe a horsefly on the top of my foot. 24 hours later, my whole foot is still swollen up like a balloon. It itches like the dickens and it's sore. It also apparently affected my voice because clearly I have laryngitis. I don't think that's related to the bug bite. Sorry for the bad voice. Anyway, I say all this as a preface only because ordinarily I am as chipper and cheerful as they come when we do a bug show. But I recognize today that for many of you, your experience with bugs can be painful, scary, frustrating. I feel your pain. That being said, we live with some amazing creatures. Beetles, spiders, moths, dragonflies. I guess we can all lump them together colloquially as bugs. And we're going to talk about them today with writer and field naturalist Brian Pfeiffer and VPR's outdoor radio co-host Kent McFarland, who's a biologist at the Vermont Center for Eco Studies. Welcome back, you guys. What a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks, Shane. Good to see you.
Great to be here.
All right, I'm going to make you talk today, and I'm going to sort of duck out of the picture here. But I understand that you both have stories that you want to share with us first as a way to kind of explain what gets you jazzed about bugs and to try to enthuse those people listening who think, bugs, ugh, I don't like anything about bugs. So, Brian, you first. You went to the Northeast Kingdom and you met a dragonfly.
I did. I mean, I was actually working up there. I've been working there all summer. I'm working up in the Northeast Kingdom. I'm actually chasing birds and insects. And I got bit by plenty of mosquitoes and black flies and horse flies and deer flies.
So you want to look at my foot?
Yeah. I'm like, wait, you got bit by a horse fly. Like, what's your point? On my way to a bog, I was bushwhacking and, you know, I'm like almost 60 and I'm thrashing around in the woods at dawn. I've been running around the Northeast Kingdom for about 30 plus years. I don't think I've seen the mosquitoes and black flies up there any worse than they are
really?
This year. And, you know, it's not always that glamorous doing this kind of work. And
is it ever?
Oh, yeah. Well, let me tell you. I'm bushwhacking and thrashing around, and I fall a lot more often than I used to. I can't read my compass without glasses, right? I need like a geriatric compass. And I'm walking in the woods, and just when I'm getting to the point where I say to myself, you know, I'm getting too old for this stuff, I come out onto this gigantic beaver wetland, this primeval beaver wetland with a boggy edge and tamarack trees growing out of a bog mat and gray jays floating around, these blue jay cousins, and they're like ghosts floating above the bog. And I leave the forest and I come out onto the bog and into the light, and I leave behind my cloud of biting insects, and I look out and I see wonderful insect, other wonderful dragonflies and butterflies, and this sort of kaleidoscope of insects in front of me. And I said to myself, "This is heaven," you know. And I really mean it. And I even asked listeners to envision or think about what you really love. Think about what you love. You know, whether it's like a Schubert piano trio, or you know, going to watch a game at Fenway, or listening to Vermont Edition. Just
right.
Think about what you love. And when you discover insects in the way that we have, and Kent and I are both, we come from the birdwatching world, you have at your feet, sometimes biting you, what you love.
Mm-hmm.
Very accessible. And it's really not something that you can describe to someone who's never really turned on to insects in the way they are, but think about what you love. And insects become a part of our life in the same way that all these other wonderful things are parts of our lives. And so that was my experience. I mean, I just was out there. It wasn't that long of a bushwhack. I don't know, it was like 3/4 of a mile to get to the spot in the woods. And then I just sort of emerged, and there I was where I wanted to be. And I could think of no better place to be at that moment than at that bog edge with these insects. And it was great.
Describe the dragonflies and what they looked like.
Well, there's a, you know, that's the thing about insects is the diversity is tremendous. And so at my feet were about, I don't know, 1.5, 2-inch long black and red dragonflies that were just flying around and doing what dragonflies do, which is basically fly around near water, kill things and eat them, and have sex. You know, that's kind of what dragonflies do. And there were these tiger swallowtails that a lot of Vermonters are probably seeing now. They're all over, these big black and yellow butterflies flying around me, drifting around. And then above me, or moving, patrolling back and forth near me, was this dragonfly. It's a group that I particularly like. Somatochlora is the genus. They're called the striped emeralds. Their eyes glow like emeralds. Their eyes, it's as if this dragonfly is generating its own light from its eyes, and they're glowing green, and it's flying right at you, and you just start to shake when you see it because it's so striking. And their bodies are like shiny metallic black with these glowing green overtones. And I did. I said to myself, I was alone. There was nobody else around except me and the mosquitoes. And I said, and you sort of tune out the mosquitoes when this happens. And I said, this is so great. This is I can think of no other place I'd rather be right now.
Kent, do you share that enthusiasm?
Oh, totally. I come from the world of ornithology. I'm a trained ornithologist. And, you know, years ago what happened to me is that I started looking at other things. You know, I'm out bird watching. I'm out doing my bird studies. And I can't help but notice other things, especially I got into butterflies years ago because they're flying all around and they're a lot like if you're a bird watcher watching butterflies, it's about the same thing. They're just smaller. You can look at them with binoculars. You can ID them with your binoculars. They're just closer. And the beautiful thing is you can sleep in and they're only out on sunny days. So I got really into looking at the small things and it just sort of became more and more just noticing, you know, I started noticing butterflies and I started noticing moths and I started noticing dragonflies and it just catches.
It's endless also.
To the point for me, like I'm not like Brian. I didn't have to trek last week out into a bog and kill my knee and have swatting flies. I actually had a religious experience in my kitchen. I was having dinner with my wife last week, and she said, "What is hopping on the table?" And it looked like a little seed, a grain. And I peered closer at it, and I realized it was a jumping spider. Talking 2-3 millimeters long, well, maybe 4 millimeters long, jumping, you know, 100 times its own length all over the table. My wife was like, "Hey, we're trying to have supper here." So I grabbed a cup and I put it over it. And then after supper, I slid a little piece of paper underneath it and carried it out onto my deck and put it on the railing where I could see it and grabbed my camera. It was so jumpy, I had time to get like 3 shots of it, but I was mesmerized. It was this furry zebra-colored big black eyes on the front of it. You know,
many
it
eyes. I saw your picture.
Yeah.
It's
and then all of a sudden, it just jumped into the abyss and was gone. I had enough for 2 pictures. Well, the crazy thing is I don't know anything about jumping spiders. I came inside and I said, "Hey, I'll take a look at Twitter. What's going on in there?" There's a tweet from an astronomer on there that says, "Hey, I just saw this crazy jumping spiders in my lab. What's going on?" And this science writer, Ed Yong, grabbed a hold of it and wrote a whole story about it for The Atlantic. It turns out the title of it was Jumping Spiders Can See the Moon. And it was all about how their vision works. It turns out that little spider that I put on my deck, its eyes are so acute, close distance and long distance, that it can pick out the craters on the moon. And it turns out, as this guy was telling these astronomers, who's a jumping spider expert, he tells them, "Hey, their eyes work just like a telescope does. There's a lens in the front, a long tube, and a lens in the back. It allows them to have this great acuity." And it just was because I saw this jumping spider and then got interested, and it just took off. So paying attention to the microfauna, yeah. It's endless. There's all kinds of stories out there. It's better than science fiction.
It's another world.
Brian, you mentioned dragonflies, and I understand you're actually working on a dragonfly atlas, and this is citizen science. You need some help with this.
You know, it's amazing. My colleague, Mike Blust, and I, we published a paper on the dragonfly fauna of Vermont a few years ago. We collected everything we knew about dragonflies in the state. We drew maps. We published it in a peer-reviewed journal, and that was sort of it. We had a lot of good information. And then along comes Kent McFarland, my colleague here, who basically has as his aspiration among many in life to map and get people involved in basically anything living in this state. So Kent created the Vermont Damselfly and Dragonfly Atlas Project with me and Mike. And we now have a website where anyone can look at what we know and also continue our expanding knowledge of dragonflies in the state. A lot of people might know about these bird atlas projects. Kent and I did one on butterflies several years ago. Now, anyone can go to this website and say, "Wow, you know, where am I going to find these common green darter dragonflies?" And Or if anyone has discovered a dragonfly, seen something they don't even know what it is, they can submit it through this portal that we have called iNaturalist. We will identify it for them if they don't know, and we will continue to build our knowledge of these insects in the state. So that's happening with just one group of insects, and we're trying to expand it to others as well.
Yeah, we had last year a citizen scientist that posted a picture of a dragonfly on iNaturalist Vermont, which you can go find on the web. He knew it was a dragonfly but didn't know what type it was. And Brian and Mike immediately saw it and said, that's a Midland clubtail. It was the second state record ever. Huh. It's a species that's moving more and more eastward from the west. And it's just another little piece of the puzzle of understanding changes in the ranges of these species, how they're doing conservation-wise, and contributed by someone that didn't know. And now they do. You know, now they're really into looking at dragonflies. So you never know what you're going to find out there if you open your eyes up and you're willing to explore a little bit and then share with others.
Well, see, I usually just share my wildlife sightings on Instagram. And then one or the other of you usually chimes in to say, oh, that's this. Or, no, you've got that ID wrong. Or, why aren't you posting this somewhere where it actually matters?
That's true. You actually had a giant swallowtail recently in your yard, I noted. Mm-hmm. And I pestered you. I said, please put that into our database.
And, you know, insects have for many, many years sort of been the domain of scientists. And now they are taking their rightful place next to birds, for example. You know, bird watchers and citizen scientists for decades have been contributing to our scientific knowledge of bird distribution and abundance. This is all happening with insects now, and we're facilitating that because not only because we want the science and we want to know, but there's immeasurable pleasure to be found among these insects. So we just really want people to share that as well.
And the great thing is the reason that's happened is because of two things. One, close focusing binoculars are pretty cheap now. You can get them really cheap. You can focus really close, like on your feet, mm-hmm. and it opens up a whole new world. It's like the microscope of entomology. You can just watch things really well now, like birders watch birds. And the other thing is digital photography. We all carry – well, most of us carry a digital camera in our pocket everywhere we go.
And a pretty good one.
A good one. It's really good. And all you have to do is snap a picture and post it onto iNaturalist Vermont, for example, or some of the other great sites online, and bam, you're helping figure out new stuff about insects.
All right. So we have a listener comment, and I'm going to have Brian – I'm going to have you read it, and
wow.
then Kent, you can answer it.
Okay. So we've heard from Dennis in Granville, and he writes, last week I day hiked down to the Big Branch on the Long Trail. And when I came near the Big Branch shelter, I saw maybe hundreds of tiger swallowtail butterflies
Sweet.
Congregating on the ground.
Yeah.
Right? They appeared to be feeding, and I thought maybe there was some minerals or salts at that spot that attracted them. I also noticed this was downhill from the shelter toilet. So could that be the source?
That is definitely the source. It's called puddling, and a lot of butterflies do this, especially the tiger swallowtails. These are Canadian tiger swallowtails. They're a northern tiger swallowtail species that we have in Vermont flying all over the place right now. They're really gorgeous, and they do that. They'll gather on dirt roads and unfortunately sometimes get hit by cars, but they'll also gather on dung.
Yeah.
They'll gather on places where people have peed, for example. And so you're finding the perfect place for them. And
yeah.
that's exactly what they're doing. They're sucking up minerals through their proboscis, which is like a little straw. And they're just down there just lapping that stuff up. It's probably – well, I don't know with tigers for sure, but often it's males that are doing this,
yeah.
trying to get a lot of energy.
Nitrogen.
Nitrogen and other
salts.
And salts.
And so you know what any good lepidopterist does when you get to a really good butterfly site? I mean,
pee.
I think we can talk about this.
You got it. Yeah.
You take a pee
no,
on the dirt
you
road.
No, you don't really.
No, you do.
Really?
You take a
no,
pee on the dirt road,
yeah.
and then you come back an hour later and it's covered with butterflies.
Yeah.
Is that scientifically ethical?
Well, yeah, you're feeding them. You're helping them, right?
Who cares?
Yeah.
It's great.
It's great. You get to see them. The other thing is you know, they do go on a lot of butterflies. You will find them on scat. Like I have great pictures of a harvester butterfly, for example, which is a beautiful butterfly, and it's right on coyote scat, just lapping it up. So we think of these things as these winged wildflowers, but they're scat lovers.
You mentioned the proboscis, and you know this is the thing that comes out and allows them to feed. Is it true? I learned recently the proboscis is like a zipper, and it can unzip because that's how they can clean themselves as well.
Well,
right?
And it's also unzipped when they're in the chrysalis. So like if you raise monarchs, for example, when a monarch first bursts out of its chrysalis called eclosure, comes out of its chrysalis, and it's unfolding its wings and letting out all that moisture and pushing its wings out. If you watch really closely, it's also will stretch its tongue out and zip the two pieces together, like you said, Jane, exactly, like a zipper.
So cool.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the other amazing thing when you think about the proboscis, so think about a caterpillar. It's got chewing mouth parts. Its life is consumed with consuming plant material. So it's a caterpillar. It's chewing things. Then it goes into a chrysalis or a cocoon in the case of moths. And it basically turns to goo, like undifferentiated goo. And then in this metamorphosis, it becomes a butterfly. And those chewing mouth parts become a proboscis. And that change alone, I mean, it's amazing enough that they develop wings and fly around. But when you think about how their feeding mechanism changes, it's incredible. Yeah. It's just really amazing.
It is remarkable. Yeah. Let's go to Sophie calling in from Shelburne. Hi, Sophie. Go right ahead.
Hi. So the other day I was collecting some multiflora rose petals, and there were all these bees, all these different kinds of bees buzzing around the rose bushes. And I noticed this one bumblebee that wasn't really moving. And after a little bit, I poked it because I couldn't tell if it was dead or alive. And I realized that inside the rose, there was this bright white spider.
Yeah. Crab spider, yeah.
Pink dot face on it, and it was attached to the face of the bumblebee. It looked like maybe it was parasitizing it or eating it. It was the craziest thing I've ever seen, and I was wondering what that was.
You pretty much nailed it. It is a crab spider, and they hang out. They have these big front legs on them, and they hang out on flowers or leaves, and sometimes they'll blend right in with the color of the flower so you can't see them. They're camouflaged, and they wait for an unsuspecting pollinator to come along to the flower, and then just as rapidly as you can imagine, they jump on it and grab it with those front legs, and then they pierce it. And what you're seeing that spider doing is actually sucking the insides of that spider into its mouth and eating it.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
and we get to the point where we can recognize when this is happening. You see something stuck to a flower, like a butterfly that should be flying around, you know a crab spider's got it even before you see the crab spider.
Yeah, you see butterflies, they get butterflies, they get bees, they get all kinds of things. They're incredibly fast, too.
Well, here's another email that may be similar. I don't know which one of you guys wants to read it for us.
All right, let's see. So Sandra posted, "For years, I have very occasionally noticed tiny crab-like insects on the walls or ceilings of various houses in Vermont. I don't remember ever seeing these creatures in other locations. They are very small, perhaps 3/16 of an inch in circumference. They somewhat resemble spiders, but have two front claws like a crab. Please don't tell me they're lice."
They're not lice. Right. No, these are probably pseudoscorpions.
Yeah. That's my favorite. Oh, yeah, I
did know that, Jane. Yeah.
And the thing is when you look at they're so tiny, too.
They're really tiny. They're
harmless.
Grab
a hand lens and look at them if you can, because it's unbelievable. They're amazing up close.
Yeah.
Oh, I find them in my shower.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
They're like wet places.
Yeah.
But explain what they are, because, you know, they are very strange looking.
They are strange. They are arachnids, mm-hmm. I believe. They are – was that right?
I guess.
I think so. Yeah. You know, we're – like I say, you know –
as soon as you go to the A word, arachnids, I'm like,
right.
Oh.
So, like, we really only deal with things with six legs, you know. But they do have – pseudoscorpions They are arachnids, and they're really tiny. They're mostly predatory, mostly nocturnal.
I mean, they're called pseudoscorpions because they're not scorpions, but they look just like,
they look like scorpions. Pinches.
Yeah, they look like a scorpion just without the little tail that crawls up at the end.
And they're super duper tiny.
Yeah, and awesome.
They really are.
Yeah, and they're not going to bother you as much as the scorpions. Like my colleague of mine, Josh Lincoln, he and I, we were in Costa Rica a few years ago, and he got in the shower, and there was an actual scorpion on his calf when he came out.
Yeah, that's not so good.
Right.
Yeah, we don't have that here.
Yeah.
All right, so our producer, Rick, has helped you guys out for mere hemming and hawing and looked it up. Pseudoscorpions are generally beneficial to humans since they prey on clothes, moth larvae, carpet beetle, book lice, ants, mites, flies, tiny and inoffensive, rarely seen due to their small size, despite being very common.
We need to have a new company. We can raise pseudoscorpions and sell them to people to clean up their houses. They can release them all through their house.
So I think they also – I think my room – some of they sometimes latch onto insects. Like they move around. They hitch rides on insects sometimes,
oh, cool.
I think.
All right. Today, our friendly experts Kent McFarland and Brian Pfeiffer are answering all of your questions about what we colloquially call bugs. Kent is the co-host of VPR's Outdoor Radio with Sarah Zahindra. Last summer, they went in search of monarch butterflies at Burlington's Intervale Center. That's several hundred acres of fields, trails, and farmland. No monarchs showed themselves, and they were ready to pack it in when this happened.
I still have some hope. I mean, we've already seen probably a dozen species of butterflies out here. This is a really great field.
It's a wonderful path.
There's an orange sulfur skipping across over there.
And they're big. They're really big. Oh, so if you see a monarch, you know it.
Oh, shoot.
Go get it. Go get it. Oh, it's way out. Keep going. Just start running. It's way out. There, it's moving fast.
I'm not seeing it.
Now go to your left this way. This way. This
left?
Way. Yeah, this way. It goes towards the road.
Go, Zahendra, go.
I'm trying. It's moving too fast.
That's outdoor radio hosts Kent McFarland and Sarah Zahendra proving that butterfly spotting really is a full contact sport.
It definitely is.
And before we go any further, we're going to go to Al, who's calling in from Whitehall, New York. Al, I was waiting for a call like yours. Go right ahead.
Well, it's great to hear a program specifically on entomology, and these guys are doing a great job. I'd like to commend National Public Radio and Vermont Public Radio and Nature and all of these programming marvels that are doing more and more to let people know about insects. My pet peeve is, though, and it has been since 1956 when I started doing entomology, is that everything now, no matter what the source, seems to be called a bug. And a bug is a specific order of insects. Spiders are arachnids, millipedes, centipedes, pseudoscorpions, all these other things are not insects, although they may be closely related. And even bacteria and rickettsia and molds and everything else that seems viruses are now all categorized as bugs, and this just drives me insane.
Oh, yeah. We've gotten this call before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what do you think?
Well,
what do you guys think?
First off, Brian, you are guilty of this too, because in slang slang world, we're always, when we're together, we're always like, oh, that was an awesome bug when like a dragonfly flies by.
Right.
And we're being slangy. And unfortunately, I think the caller is Al's totally correct that it's gotten carried away.
Yeah.
Totally
and
away.
So the bugs, what we call the true bugs, is so they're insects, there's about, depending on how you count them, there are 30 groups or orders of insects, as Al well knows. And one of the groups is the Hemiptera, and they are colloquially called the true bugs. And for some reason, bug, that is caught on to describe lots of insects. So, yes, this is true, but colloquially, we do send – or I sometimes say, oh, that was an amazing beast. I'll call them beasts sometimes, you know.
But it is true. For people that are the uninitiated, we're not helping by doing that.
I
mean, you know. There is a big difference. A good example of the difference is something you and I were just talking about this morning, which is, you know, I come from the bird world. So chimney swifts, for example, that are flying over the city right now. I heard some walking here in Montpelier flying over. They nest in our chimneys and in hollow trees. They've undergone population decline recently and some work recently in Canada where they went to roost. They roost in these old smokestacks from old factories. And they went to these roosts, and there's lots of guano inside there. And they drilled down through 50 years of guano to see what the chimney swifts had regurgitated. They regurgitated
what they eat.
What they eat.
It's an archaeological record of chimney swift diet.
That's so cool.
Well, it turns out that chimney swifts used to be feeding on beetles.
Coleoptera.
A lot of Coleoptera beetles. And then after the DDT era, it changed the whole fauna in the air for these things, and they started feeding on
Hemiptera. So they found Hemiptera remains in what's left over from these chimney swifts.
So when you read the story, though, they say, oh, they started eating bugs.
Right.
Well, it's important to know that bugs are Hemiptera.
And
not just
everything.
They're
not beetles.
Yeah, exactly.
See, otherwise, you'd say, weren't they always eating
bugs? It has implications for population and conservation of chimney swifts. We've learned about, you know, even without really knowing them, you know, we can just sort of look back in time and see how their diets have changed. We do that through insects.
Yep.
So is there another word we should use?
There goes a really cool insect.
Insect is good.
Yeah, it's good.
Except then we talk about pseudoscorpions.
We could actually.
Yeah.
All right. Well, okay. Al, point taken.
Yeah.
We hear you. We hear you loud and clear. Let's go to Vicky in Middlebury. Hey, Vicky, go right ahead.
Hi. First of all, I think insect is kind of a little bit stuffy. So cute.
Totally with you.
But
a raging controversy right now.
After rains, I've noticed little tiny, like 1-millimeter-sized carnations, little tiny red bugs crawling across my patio, across my legs, the furniture, and we have flowers near there. So I was wondering if these are aphids or if they're good. Like we were thinking about buying some
ladybugs to eat them, or if are they? What are they? What are their ecology?
Well, yeah. No, that's a really good question. Yeah. I've seen it too. I think Brian has the case of it, but again, here's a case of. Just kidding, Brian.
Yeah, I got rid of those, you know, a long time ago.
But here's a case where you need to look closely at the organism and count how many legs they have, for example. And it goes back to what Al is saying. You know, it's some of those key things. Like, did this thing have 8 legs or did it have 6 legs? And I'm guessing Brian's got the answer here. I'm guessing it has 8 legs, right, Brian?
Yeah, because this is one of the spider mites or the harvest mites. These little tiny red things. I mean, crimson.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they will get into the house sometime too. You'll see these little tiny mites.
Did you happen to look at it closely enough to see how many legs it has, or?
No.
Next time.
Yeah, but now you know.
Next time.
Yeah, take a close look at it and see how many legs it has. You know, and then look up like velvet mite. These beautiful, gorgeous, bright red mites that are tiny and they're arachnids.
But speaking of aphids, I saw aphids being farmed the other day, and I had never seen that. That is so cool.
Yeah.
It's spiders, right, that farm the aphids or other
ants? Ants.
Yeah, ants often do this.
That's
what it was.
Yeah, and that happens with certain butterfly caterpillars as well. The caterpillars will secrete what we call colloquially, is that a good word? You know, commonly honeydew, you know, and the ants offer protection to the caterpillars. We see this in the Lycaenids, the little azures, these little blue butterflies, and the caterpillars get protection and the ants get the sweetness.
They sort of milk them?
They will. The ants will actually take a drop off the posterior end of the caterpillar.
I don't know if they're actually milking them.
Yeah, not milking them. Yeah.
I prefer to think of it that way.
No, that's fine, yeah.
Let's go to Frederick in Holy Bear, Quebec. Hi, Frederick. Go ahead.
Oh. Hello. I was wondering, are there any important ramifications if we manage to eradicate mosquitoes in North America?
Yeah, I think you've stumped them.
I think so. Yeah.
What would the problem be?
Well, I mean, if you just think about the biomass in mosquitoes and what feeds on them, I mean, there's a lot, you know, dragonflies, for example, feed on mosquitoes.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of things that feed on them. It's a huge amount of biomass. And then I'm just thinking about the adults flying around, let alone all the larvae in the water and everything that feeds in the water column on mosquito larvae.
Right.
So I understand where you're coming from, and I'm almost with you. But I know there's got to be just lessons learned from doing this before with other organisms. We see ramifications that we don't really understand, and I just feel like the biomass is so big it would be really bad to do.
Yeah, and it's terrestrial and aquatic because mosquitoes, as many insects are, they're of two worlds. You know, the larvae are in water and there are food supply there and then, of course, on land.
And there's, you know, I think there's something like 13 or 14 mosquito species or maybe is it more than that?
Maybe
in Vermont? 20 something?
Yeah.
God, I once knew that. Alan is going to kill me.
Yeah.
I don't remember.
Yeah, you know, I live with mosquitoes a lot in my work, and I have this sort of approach to it where I try to take this sort of zen-like approach to them and just tune in all the dragonflies and butterflies that I'm really into, and I try to make it so that the mosquitoes just are not part of my sphere. And
how's that working for you?
It just does not work at all.
I want to correct myself. Because I just looked it up.
Okay.
There's 45 known species of mosquitoes in Vermont.
There you go.
45. And only 6 of them really kind of bother humans. So.
Oh.
Yeah.
Really?
It's a minority that bother us.
So we only need to get rid of those 6.
Yeah, get rid of the 6 and keep the others.
Right.
All right. Here's another email. And this one is from VPR's own Nina Keck.
Nina writes, I was out walking yesterday and was so excited to see a monarch.
Excellent.
But then I noticed it was being dive bombed by what looked like 2 mini monarchs. Whoa. Right. Much smaller orange butterflies.
Yeah.
It looked like an old-fashioned airplane battle with the monarchs swooping this way and that to get away, only to have the 2 smaller butterflies right on its tail. What was this all about?
Well, what you have is a viceroy. It mimics monarchs, I think, is probably what's happening. And I'm guessing. And it flew into the territory of the viceroys, and it looks like a viceroy, so they chased him for a little while until they realized, like,
you believe Nina is correct that there was a monarch and then it was chased by 2 viceroys, or was it a viceroy being chased by 2 smaller butterflies?
Yeah. Oh, it could be that too.
I don't know. So that's the way I read it.
Here's the other. That's
but
a,
but
that's
so
a
but
good
I'm
hypothesis.
An evangelist now
right,
for
right.
for knowing the difference between a viceroy and a monarch.
Right.
Well
here's
break
what
that
I'll
down.
Tell you. Well, my the point is that some butterflies are territorial. They'll sit on a perch. They'll wait for something to fly by, the male, and we'll chase after it, see if it's a female. Okay. So like morning cloaks are great for this. It sits by your house and you walk by and it'll check you. I go, no, you're not a female morning cloak. Off it goes back to its perch. As Kent said, this was probably over a nectar source. So maybe this monarch was nectaring, and it could have been crescents also.
Yeah, because mini ones, right. Viceroys okay. and monarchs are similar sized.
Viceroys are a little smaller.
All right, you guys convinced me.
Yeah, so crescents are really, they're one of the most common butterflies in North America. And it could have just been, hey, you're on my nectar source here. And the crescents could have been hitting up the monarch to try and knock it off the planet.
But how do we know it was a monarch? Maybe it was a viceroy.
Could have been a viceroy.
All right, so here's my understanding of monarchs and viceroys.
Yeah.
Monarchs are slightly bigger, and when you look at their bottom wings, it's the nice orange patterns that go all the way to the bottom. And a viceroy has a line
correct.
That kind of cuts through the wing.
A black line.
Yeah, a black
yes.
line on the bottom
it
wings.
It cuts across the longitudinal veins. They all go from the middle of the body out toward the tip of the body. On the monarch, and the viceroy's got that too. It's a mimic, but the giveaway is that crossing vein.
But for several years, when we were hearing about the decline in monarchs, I kept thinking, I'm seeing monarchs, until I realized I'm not actually seeing monarchs, I'm seeing viceroys.
And right now, there are some monarchs around, and in fact, there's a bunch of reports coming in of people finding legitimate monarchs, but there is a big flight of viceroys going on right now. I ran into a bunch of them the other day. Along the river because they like willow trees. They like willow trees for their caterpillars, and they lay eggs on them. The other thing to know about them is they look like each other because they're both poisonous. Monarchs are distasteful, and it turns out viceroys are also distasteful. They get their poisons from different plants. Viceroys get it from salix, from willows, and monarchs get it from milkweed. But they're both distasteful, so they look alike to warn predators like, hey, we both are bad tasting. It's called a Mullerian mimic.
And you know what else is really cool about viceroys? So the butterfly that viceroys are most closely related to are not monarchs. They're the butterfly we call white admirals. They're the dark butterfly with the bold white stripes across the wing.
They're on dirt roads a lot right now.
Yeah, they're flying right now. And those viceroys that look like monarchs are very closely related to white admirals.
Let's go to Suzanne calling in from Burlington. Hi, Suzanne. Go right ahead.
Hi, this is Suzanne. I'm calling up with a little bit of a different question. My mom died at hospice in Florida, and on a lot of the hospice doors were posted little dragonflies. And when she died, they put one on her door. Since her death, my mother has come to me over the years three times, always as a dragonfly. Is there some relationship spiritually with dragonflies and spirit life?
Well, this is a great question, Suzanne, because actually I think there is, because I've heard this question often. And I don't know actually what that connection may be, but dragonflies, oddly enough, you know, in Western cultures tend to be associated, you know, not with great things, like we used to call them devil's darning needles, for example. But in many other places around the world, particularly in Asia, they are sacred insects. And it's just I don't really have an explanation to it, but I've heard this before. So there's some significance, I think, with the fact that these dragonflies are kind of supreme insects and just sort of commanding their space. And so there probably is some sort of association there. And I think it's just sort of a beautiful notion. And I think there is something to it because I hear it a lot.
Yeah, and wonderful to be able to feel that presence regardless, and to feel that that creature next to you that is so beautiful and magnificent in a way. Let's go to another call here. Karen is calling in from Hemingford, Quebec. Hi, Karen.
Hi, this is Karen. I found a really fascinating insect. Do you want to say something about clear wing moths? Because I was thrilled when I finally found out what it was, and a few more details about it.
Yeah, no, clear-wing moths are unbelievable. I'm glad you discovered them. These are diurnal moths, moths that fly in the daytime, and they come to flowers. They're really big nectars of flowers, and they're big pollinators. And it turns out actually that a bunch of the species may be declining right now. And there's some work afoot in the Northeast to actually start to get a grip on that in the future, using citizen scientists to watch for these clear-wing moths and find out what's going on with them. But yeah, just like you said, they have clear wings. You can see through many of the cells of the wings. They almost behave like a hummingbird. They come up to the flower and sort of hover. And sometimes at first people might think they're even seeing a hummingbird. And I've even seen chases between hummingbirds and clear wings. They try to chase the clear wings away from some of these flowers. And they have these really long tongues, these really long proboscis that can reach into certain flower types better than any other moths.
And their tongues kind of hang out as they're feeding, which you don't see that. Yeah. Like, flying around, their tongues hang out. Their proboscis is hanging out.
Yeah, if you use your digital – this is fun to do if you just are hanging out in your gardens and you see one. If you take like rapid shots of your digital camera and then look at them, you'll see it. They're like the Michael Jordan of moths. Their tongue is just hanging out. Hanging way out as they're doing a slam dunk of the flower.
And even though there are no scales that are marking their wings, or very few scales marking their wings, and their wings are therefore clear, their bodies are really ornate. There's often these sort of rich rust and with white stripes on them or yellow markings.
Oh, cool.
There's a few species of them here.
All right. I just gave Kent another email to read.
Oh, great. So we got an email from Andrew and Adamant, and he said, yesterday while walking my dog, I was besieged with black flies. Well past the time they have usually have vanished. They always come out here around Mother's Day, but this year they were out at least a week early, and the little buggers are still out 6 weeks later, making life miserable outdoors. What gives? Did the cool wet weather allow them to survive longer? Are there different hatches?
Yeah, so there are. There are, I don't know, how many species of black flies you think there are in Vermont? 20? I'm going to guess 15, 20. We don't know. I don't. Someone knows. But basically, as we often say, there's really never one. There's never one black fly. So there could be a different generations of insects, but more likely there are different species of black fly. So the first ones usually emerge in early May. I tend to see clouds of black flies. Usually the males emerge first and they're not biting. They're just kind of hovering around you and you realize they're not biting you. Then the females come and they're biting you. And I suspect it's just a different species of black fly that's emerged.
Well, you know, bringing up different species of black fly, there's even species of black flies that only bite certain birds. So there's a species that bites loons. And in fact, a couple weeks ago, we had a few loon nests fail because they were being pestered by black flies so badly. And you can go on our webpage and see this. There's pictures of female loons on the nest, and their heads are absolutely covered with black flies. Mm. And it, just like us, it bothers the heck out of them, and they tend to get on and off the nest, and eventually they just can't take it, and they're off the nest too long, and their nest fails. So it's not just us that gets pestered by these things. It's a lot of things. There's examples of raptor nestlings actually being killed by them.
Yeah.
And for birds, these things transmit disease to birds.
Yeah.
So we're lucky in that sense with them at least. We're only just giving them a little sample of our flesh.
You know, Adamant has the Black Fly Festival every
year. Yeah, the celebration.
So this is a continuation of that.
That's right.
I was feeling like he's the expert, right?
Yeah.
He lives there.
That's right. Let's go to Judy calling in from Facetown. Hi, Judy. Go right ahead.
Hi, everybody. Brian, so good to hear you again. This is about fireflies or lightning bugs, which I am afraid that the current generation of kids and teens and so on will never see them because they used to be beautiful at nighttime, light up my woods and everything. They're gone.
Judy, you can come to my house. I still have
everywhere.
Them.
Yeah, there's concern about declines in fireflies now. I'm seeing them, you know, now is really great. Next 2 weeks are going to be great for fireflies. Wet meadows is good habitat for them. But yes, mowing will harm firefly populations. And you should also know there's not one firefly species in Vermont. We think there's maybe 15 or 20 different firefly species. The males are now displaying. They're doing some of them do distinctive flash patterns, and the females will respond with their own flash pattern. It's their communication for mating. So yeah, I think there's an article in Northern Woodlands magazine about fireflies right now, which I haven't had the chance to read yet. But yeah, there was concern about declining fireflies.
And let's go to Tom in Roxbury. Hey, Tom, go right ahead.
Hi, how you doing? Hey, great show. Listen, I've been watching chimney swifts here down in Roxbury, and they feed really high up. And I wondered how high insects really go.
Well, that's a good question. And it turns out they go really,
really high.
And no, seriously, they go very high. There was a really interesting study out of the United Kingdom recently where they actually for, oh gosh, I don't know, 30 or 40 years, they did studies with they had balloons that went way up and had these devices that captured the insects up high. And then more recently, they started using these side-viewing radar pointed up at the sky. And their purpose was is to try to monitor the movements of insects in spring and fall. They wanted to know what was going on in the higher levels. And it was thousands and thousands of feet high. Some of the spiders that we have, actually, they do what's called ballooning. And they'll extend out a whole bunch of silk and then they'll just get caught up in the air and they'll rise up tens and thousands of feet high and sail, you know, kind of around the world on the jet stream. Yeah. So there's stuff really high up, you know, maybe not as high as where it gets up to where there's jetliners, but.
All right. One more call in here from Peter in Waterford. Hi, Peter. Go right ahead.
This is a wonderful program. Thank you. I had a pot of well-rotted Japanese beetles that I'd been collecting, and I noticed that it captured a few carrion beetles. And I released them. One died and one recovered. But as I was watching it with a magnifying glass, I noticed about a dozen mites its back.
Oh, yeah.
And
as it
extended its wings to dry, they all gathered where the two carapaces meet for flight. And they gathered along that, almost like sailors riding a ship. And then the beetle folded its wings up again, and they disappeared back under the carapace. And the beetle kind of took a little while to recover, and eventually it took off, but it had these sailors on board. And I was just wondering if you'd noticed that or you knew what that was. And I'll take my answer off the
I see thing. These big black and red beetles. They come into my moth light at night, and they often have. I can't remember the genus. It starts with an N, but yeah. These are mites that are – do you know about these?
Yeah. Well, yeah. It turns out the mites can't fly and the beetles can.
They're hitching a ride.
So they hitch a ride with the beetles because the beetles are going to go find more carrion to lay eggs on. And these mites need the carrion too. So they're hitching a ride on the beetle. They're literally riding it like a – they're cowboys. They're insect cowboys. They're not mites. They're actually arachnid cowboys. So yeah, they're just flying around with these mites, so they can get to the carrion also. And yeah, you can find them covered in these things, these beetles. It's amazing.
Kent, before the show started, I very proudly told you that I have rusty patched bumblebees in my yard, and you told me, no, you probably don't. So tell me why we should be carrying and trying to identify rusty patched bumblebees.
Yeah, so Vermont always leads the nation, and we did it again. We declared rusty patch bumblebee 3 years ago as an endangered species in Vermont. And now, just recently, a couple months ago, it was listed as federally endangered. It used to be dirt common, this bee. It was in everybody's yard probably. Students at UVM collected it easily for their classes. And suddenly, in the late 1990s, it disappeared. The last one we saw was in 1999. So we're desperately seeking this bumblebee, and we want everyone to stay excited. But the problem is as its name suggests, it has a rusty patch on its lower – on its upper back, on its abdomen. And unfortunately, there's a couple other bees that also have that. And one of them is a really common bee in our gardens called the tricolored bumblebee. And it has a bright orange or red patch, two patches actually on it. And so I get a lot of emails of pictures with people really excited that they found that. And it almost always turns out to be tricolored bumblebee. Versus rusty patch bumblebee, which has a smaller rusty patch. But I still want everyone to stay really excited
and
keep emailing
them. Yeah, send them.
Send the sightings. So where do people send sightings if they get them?
All sightings of anything alive, insects, including bugs, please send them to iNaturalist Vermont. If you go online and go to iNaturalist Vermont, you can post your pictures there whether you know what they are or not. It goes into a database, and there's tons of naturalists like us on there and professional entomologists. And eventually they get identified, and they're in the database forever. And it's a great resource. There's hundreds of people doing it. And join us and help discover Vermont's biodiversity.
And we'll put a link up at vpr.net. Kent McFarland is co-host of VPR's Outdoor Radio. You can listen to that and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or at vpr.net. He's also a biologist at the Vermont Center for Eco Studies. Brian Pfeiffer is a writer and field naturalist. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks, Jane. It was
super
fun. This was great.